You know, it's kind of wild to think about, like, the incredible journey our own brains have taken, you know, to become what they are today. We're talking about a story that's been, what, billions of years in the
Big
making?
begins, yeah.
And that's exactly what we're diving into today, this whole evolution of brains and minds.
Right, you sent over a fascinating chapter, actually, that serves as a kind of introduction to cognitive science, and a big chunk of it explores the evolutionary path of brains. So our goal in this deep dive really is to unpack how that evolutionary history has shaped who we are, you know, at the most fundamental level, looking at different ways of thinking about the relationship between the mind and the brain.
Okay, so let's just jump right into it, right?
Yeah.
Our mission for you today is to extract, like, the most important nuggets of knowledge about brain evolution, the different ways scientists try to understand the mind, and some pretty surprising facts about how brains have developed and the sheer diversity we see across different species.
Absolutely.
And we're going to try to do this without getting too bogged down in, like, the technical jargon.
Yeah.
We want this to be clear and engaging for everyone.
Totally. The source material kicks off by outlining four main perspectives in cognitive science. The first one is classical cognitivism, and this, as you might guess, views the mind in a more traditional way as a symbolic information processing system. So, kind of like a computer dealing with abstract symbols and algorithms.
Right. So it's that idea that there's, like, a central processor in the brain working step by step, processing information based on rules.
Exactly. And the source mentions that this approach has actually had some success, especially in those well-defined rule-based situations like playing board games, solving logic puzzles, things like
Right,
that.
because those have clear rules and limited possibilities.
Exactly. But of course, as you know, the real world is a lot messier than a chessboard, right?
Way messier. Life throws curveballs all the time.
Right. And so the limitations of this approach became really clear when people tried to apply it to the complexity of everyday life. The brain doesn't seem to have that kind of central processor working in a linear, step-by-step fashion.
Okay, that makes sense.
Which leads us to the second perspective, connectionism.
And this is where we start thinking about the brain as more, what, distributed system. Lots of interconnected processes happening all at once without necessarily relying on those rigid symbolic structures of the classical view.
Precisely.
It feels a lot more, well, realistic to me, you know?
Right, more like the messy reality of how things actually work. These connectionist models have actually been really helpful in understanding things like how we perceive the world, how we reason, and even how we use language.
Wow, that's pretty broad.
Yeah, but they still have their limits, particularly when it comes to the nitty-gritty of sensory analysis, you know, how we take in information from our senses and how we actually control our bodies.
Okay, so those are kind of like the more abstract models of the mind. Then we come to the third perspective, which is embodied cognitive science. And this one really emphasizes the interaction, the back and forth between the organism and its environment, right? It's suggesting that our mental processes aren't just happening inside our heads, but are shaped by our actual physical interactions with the world around us.
That's a really crucial point. You think about something like learning to ride a bike.
Yeah, it's not just a mental thing, is it?
It's not. It's not just about understanding the physics. It's the physical interaction, the constant adjustment that shapes your mental understanding of balance. And finally, we have neurocognitive science. And this one grounds our understanding of the mind firmly in the biological reality of the brain.
Okay, so this is where the neurons come in.
Exactly. It relies heavily on neurobiology. That's the study of the nervous system and neuropsychology, which looks at how brain function relates to our behavior and cognitive abilities.
Right, so it sounds like each of these perspectives is giving us, like, a different window into the mind, different tools for different jobs, basically. But ultimately, you know, understanding the mind probably requires integrating all of these perspectives, right?
You're right. Using all of these to approach the complexity, the source actually makes a really good point here, drawing a parallel to other scientific fields.
Okay.
It says, just as we don't try to explain everything in the universe solely through genetics or quantum physics, each of these cognitive science paradigms has its own place where it's most useful, where it's easiest to apply.
It's about using the right tool for the job. Like, you wouldn't use a hammer to screw in a light bulb.
Right, exactly. Each perspective has its strengths and its limitations.
Okay, so here's where it starts to get really interesting for me. The source brings up this, like, seemingly paradoxical relationship between me and my brain.
Right.
It's like my brain has me, but I also feel like I have my brain.
It's not a one-way street, right? You're hitting on something really important here. The relationship is definitely not linear. Mental events, your thoughts, your feelings, They actively influence your brain, changing its activity. We call this neurodynamics.
Neurodynamics, so that's like the electrical and chemical activity happening in the brain.
Exactly. It's constantly changing, constantly in flux. And this is the foundation from which your thoughts and feelings emerge. But at the same time, what's happening in your brain dictates the mental states that can even arise. Your perception of the world, whether it's from external senses or internal processes, like when you're dreaming, all of that depends on the states your brain can generate.
So it's like we're only getting a glimpse of what's really going on in there, right? A shadow of neurodynamics, as the source puts it.
That's a great way to put it.
It makes you wonder, like, what about all the processing that's happening that we're not consciously aware of?
Right. There's a whole lot going on beneath the surface, as they say. The source describes the mind as a subset of these countless neuronal processes. It's the ones that kind of break through to our conscious awareness. They represent the strongest synchronizations of neuron groups, creating stable states, but only for brief periods, you know, something like a tenth of a second.
Oh, that's so fast.
It is. And the interesting thing is, this was just a hypothesis for a long time, but brain research over the last few decades has really started to solidify this understanding.
Okay, so with all these different ways of thinking about the mind, how do we even define what the mind and intelligence actually are? It seems so nebulous, so hard to pin down.
That's a fundamental question, and the source acknowledges that it's incredibly difficult to define these terms precisely. I mean, even everyday language carries so many different meanings.
Yeah, and then you add in different languages and cultures, it gets really complicated.
Exactly. So trying to come up with a single, neat scientific definition is tricky.
It's like trying to define happiness, right? Everyone has a general idea, but trying to get down to a precise definition that captures every nuance. Good luck.
Right. It's elusive. However, the source does offer some working definitions. It describes the mind as basically a control system that determines an organism's behavior and its interactions with a complex environment.
Okay, that makes sense. It's about how we navigate the world around us.
Right. It's about responding and adapting. And then it defines intelligence as the ability to use knowledge to achieve goals.
Okay, so those are pretty good starting points. But for this deep dive, we're really focusing on the mind as this collection of functions that we can consciously realize.
Yeah.
Right? The things that make us feel like us, like we have a mind.
Yes, that's the focus here. The source mentions things like perception, memory, emotions, thinking, learning, attention, decision-making, self-awareness, self-representation. So all those processes that define how we interact with the world and allow us to reflect on our own internal states.
And it sounds like the boundary of the mind might even extend to some of those unconscious processes, right?
Right.
The ones that we're not directly aware of, but that can still have a noticeable impact on our thoughts and actions.
Sure.
It's like there's a hidden hand influencing our decisions.
That's a really important nuance. The line isn't always so clear.
Yeah.
There are many processes that regulate our body's internal balance, like temperature, heart rate, and breathing. These operate outside of our conscious awareness, but their influence becomes very apparent when they malfunction and we feel the effects at the mental level.
Right. You only really notice them when something goes wrong. Like, you don't think about your heartbeat until it starts racing for no reason.
Exactly. So mental processes are not fixed. They evolve as we learn new skills, becoming aware of previously unnoticed sensations. Mental processes can be altered by various disruptions in the nervous system.
You know, it's so easy to take our brains for granted when everything is working smoothly. We're operating on this mental level, interacting with the world, and we don't really think about the intricate machinery that's humming away in our skulls, making it all possible.
Right. We're caught up in our thoughts and experiences. The source talks about this long history of ideas, about the role of spirit or soul, often seen as separate from the body, kind of synonymous with mind and consciousness. But as we've discussed before, the belief in a soul really rests on illusions that are instilled in childhood and perpetuated by religion and culture.
Right, right.
And for millennia, this line of thinking really led to a lot of paradoxes, you know, not much progress in actually understanding the mind.
It's the physical brain that's doing the work.
It is. The source even points out that the mind is just a tiny fraction of what the brain actually does. Thousands of things are happening all the time without our conscious awareness to keep us alive.
Okay, so this brings us back to that really powerful idea of the mind as a shadow of neurodynamics.
Right.
It's a way of saying that our conscious experience is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yes.
It's this tiny part of the vast, intricate activity happening in our brains.
Think about it like this. You know those moments when a thought just pops into your head seemingly out of nowhere?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Well, that might be a glimpse of those powerful neural synchronizations breaking through to your awareness.
It's like a little burst of activity amidst all the chaos.
Exactly. These consciously accessible processes, they stand out against the background of neural activity. And as we said, this is a well-supported understanding thanks to decades of brain research. So the next logical step is to consider what are brains and what do they do? Without that basic knowledge, discussing the mind becomes pretty difficult.
Right, you got to start with the foundations.
You do. And we often hear people say that, you know, we don't know anything about the brain.
Yeah.
But as the source rightly points out, that's usually true only if someone hasn't studied cognitive science. Humanity has actually accumulated quite a lot of knowledge about the brain.
Right. It's just that it's like insanely complex.
It is incredibly complex. To really start to understand brains, the source suggests that we should first characterize them broadly and then look at them from an evolutionary perspective.
Okay, so the why of brains.
Exactly. Why did brains even evolve in the first place? And what different kinds of brains exist across the animal kingdom? Now, we'll try to understand how brains work at different levels of analysis, although, as the source notes, we won't go too deep into the specifics of sensory systems, genetics, or individual neurons today. Those are topics for their own deep dives.
Right. We're keeping the focus on the big picture of brain evolution and how it relates to the mind.
Exactly. And the source highlights that there are two broad ways to look at how brains function. The evolutionary perspective, so the why, and the descriptive functional perspective, the how something is actually realized.
Okay, so why versus how?
Exactly. Let's start with that evolutionary lens. So the source poses this fundamental question. When faced with threats, does the immune system learn entirely new ways to respond? Or does it rather select from a repertoire of possibilities that have been established through evolution?
That's a really interesting way to frame it. It's like, does the immune system invent new solutions on the fly, or does it draw from a pre-existing toolbox that evolution has provided?
Right, exactly. And this question actually echoes that classic nature versus nurture debate when it comes to human and animal development.
That's a great parallel. So from that evolutionary perspective, it seems like the brain's capabilities have been shaped through natural selection, favoring those ways of acting that are beneficial for survival. It's all about what gives an organism an edge in the game of life, right?
Precisely. And this selection has happened at the level of basic reflexes, perception, attention, the fact that we tend to only perceive what might be important for us. It's shaped our capacity for reasoning and potentially even our language abilities.
It's amazing to think about how those basic building blocks have shaped, like, everything we do.
It is. And the source actually brings up the example of children who are born without senses.
Oh, wow.
These are very rare cases, often resulting from genetic mutations that affect protein production. But they really demonstrate how evolution has sculpted specific brain structures responsible for analyzing sensory input and controlling appropriate responses.
So it's a reminder of how intricately our senses and our brains are linked.
They are. And how much we rely on those fundamental structures that have evolved over, you know, millions and millions of years. And then the source highlights the incredible diversity of animal senses. Think about all the ways animals perceive the world.
Right. We tend to think of our five senses as the standard, but there is a whole other world of sensory experiences out there.
Exactly. I mean, you have smell, taste, and then the ability to sense vibrations in the ground and in the air. And these vibrations can range from infrasound, which is too low for us to hear, to ultrasound, which is too high for us to hear. Then you have precise touch, which is so crucial for balance, and the ability to detect electromagnetic radiation. And this can go from infrared, which we perceive as heat, all the way to ultraviolet light, which is beyond the visible spectrum for us.
It's mind-boggling.
And some animals can even detect weak electric and magnetic fields.
Really? That's amazing.
It is. Have you ever noticed how certain smells can evoke such strong memories?
Oh, yeah, totally. It's like a time machine sometimes.
Well, that's your sensory apparatus at work, shaped by millions of years of evolution.
Wow.
And what's even more remarkable is that all this diverse sensory information, it gets converted into electrical impulses that brains can then analyze. And this is thanks to neurons, which are actually surprisingly similar across most species.
So it's like a common language that brains speak, regardless of what kind of sensory input they're getting.
That's a great way to put it. And brains also show a fundamental similarity in their organization, often with what we call nuclei. So these are clusters of neurons with specialized functions. And then a layered cortex, which has a very large surface area for information processing.
So if there's useful information encoded in those electrical impulses, regardless of where they come from, it seems like brains have this kind of universal algorithm that they can learn to exploit, right?
That's the key insight.
Like the brain is saying, give me the data, I can figure it out.
That's it. And the source even suggests that this commonality opens up the possibility of adding new senses in the future.
Whoa, wait, what? New senses.
Yeah. If we can convert information from, say, external sensors into signals that the brain can understand, it might actually be able to utilize them.
That's like some next level stuff. That's straight out science fiction. Okay, so now the source talks about different speeds of learning in this evolutionary context. Yeah. There's fast learning and slower learning.
Right. Fast learning in a natural environment is seen as a selection process, like a competition between neurons and brain circuits, where nature's possibilities are kind of tested and refined through natural selection. And this applies mainly to basic forms of perception, but there's also slower learning.
Right.
And this unfolds over months and years, often driven by like new opportunities, new affordances that arise in the environment.
Like language, writing, music, mathematics. Those aren't things that we're born knowing.
Exactly.
They're cultural innovations that our brains have, like, adapted to.
Right. And these require specialized brain areas to quickly process acoustic information into phones for language understanding, visual information into recognizable characters for reading, or musical notation for performance.
Right.
The increased population density after the rise of cities created a need for specialized face recognition abilities.
Right.
The automation of these new functions demands specialization in specific areas of the cerebral cortex. And as the source mentions, neuropsychology studies how these functions can be disrupted in various ways, like by specific brain damage.
So it's like these basic movement circuits are the evolutionary building blocks, and then more complex behaviors are kind of layered on top of that.
That's a good way to think about it.
And this diversity we see among humans, it's not just about our appearance, is it? The source brings up that thing about the difficulty of finding bone marrow donors, highlighting just how different we all are on a genetic level.
That's right.
So it's like we're in this constant evolutionary arms race with like germs and diseases, and genetic diversity is what keeps some of us ahead of the curve, ensuring the survival of the species.
That's a great analogy. This diversity is absolutely crucial for survival.
Yeah.
If we were all genetically identical, a single disease could potentially wipe out the entire human race.
Yeah.
And the source references this thing called the Red Queen principle here.
Okay, I've heard of that. It was from Alice in Wonderland, right?
It is, but it's been adopted by evolutionary biologists.
Okay.
It's this idea that organisms need to constantly adapt and evolve just to maintain their relative fitness in an ever-changing environment. Especially when you think about parasites, bacteria, viruses, all those things. Resistance to these threats requires variation.
So we're not static beings. We're constantly evolving.
Precisely. The source emphasizes that humans are dynamic processes.
Yeah.
Constantly changing from that initial fertilized cell to the trillions of cells that make us up. Cells that are themselves constantly regenerating and slowly changing.
Right.
We tend to perceive ourselves as stable structures, looking for those consistent personality traits. But in reality, we're processes with variable dynamics, not fixed entities. Our bodies change throughout life. And while some of these changes are very slow, you know, like the hands on a clock, our brains can change relatively quickly, especially in childhood.
Right.
You might not see structural changes without sophisticated imaging, like MRI, but we definitely see the effects of those changes in behavior, particularly in how quickly a child's brain adapts and learns. Millions of new synapses are forming every second, rapidly reshaping a child's brain.
That's insane. Okay, so shifting gears a bit. The source dives into the why behind some of our sensory abilities, like why we see colors. And it makes this distinction between the evolutionary perspective, the why something evolved, and the descriptive perspective, the how something is actually realized.
Right. That's an important distinction to make. The evolutionary perspective helps us to understand the selective pressures that led to the development of certain traits. So, for example, why do we see colors in the range that we do? Well, the source actually outlines at least four key evolutionary reasons for color vision.
Okay, so lay them on us. Why do we see in color?
First, attracting insects and other animals that help pollinate plants or disperse seeds. Second, for attracting prey, camouflage, and hiding from predators against different backgrounds. Third, as a warning signal to predators, you know, like, hey, I'm poisonous, don't eat me.
Right, right.
And fourth, for sexual selection, attracting mates or deterring rivals.
That makes perfect sense. Color plays such a huge role in all those things.
It does. Now, for mammals specifically, color vision was particularly useful for distinguishing different types of grasses and for spotting ripe fruits from a distance.
Oh, right, because the red of the fruit would really pop against the green leaves.
Exactly. Now, because of all these different selective pressures, animals have evolved to see colors in very diverse ways.
Yeah, the variations are incredible. Like, we have three types of color receptors, humans and primates do, but other mammals mostly have two.
Right.
And then marine mammals only have one, which means they see in black and white.
Yeah, it's called monochromatic vision.
Monochromatic. But then you have tropical fish and birds that have four color receptors, and pigeons have five.
Five.
And insects, like bees, they have three, but they're shifted into the ultraviolet spectrum. It's like nature's been experimenting with every possible way of seeing the world.
It really is. And the source points out that what appears to us as white flowers often have distinct colors in the ultraviolet range, and insects can see those.
So the colors of flowers are really for insects,
yeah.
Not primarily for us.
Exactly. And then you have butterflies, which have six photoreceptors, and the mantis shrimp, it holds the record with a staggering 12.
12. That's insane.
It is. However, the source notes that the mechanism of color vision can differ. Some animals with many photoreceptors might actually sacrifice spatial resolution for rapid color detection without needing extensive neural processing in the brain like we mammals do.
Oh, so it's a trade-off. You can either see things really sharply, or you can see a wider range of colors, but not both at the same time.
Exactly. It all depends on what's most advantageous for that animal's survival.
Right, right. And I remember the source mentioning that the number of color shades we can distinguish is also tied to this, right?
Yeah.
Like monochromatic vision allows you to see about 200 shades of gray. Dichromatic vision, which is what most mammals have, that's about 10,000 shades. And then our human eyes, with trichromatic vision, we can see something like a million shades.
That's the current estimate.
It's crazy to think about all the colors we're missing out on. And speaking of missing out, the source also reminds us that each person's color perception is slightly different, which is what led to that whole the dress thing a while back, where some people saw it as white and gold and others saw it as black and blue.
Yes, that was a fascinating example of individual differences in color perception. And when we dive deeper into the visual system, we also encounter the reasons for visual illusions, which further demonstrate how our brains construct our perception of reality.
Right. It's not just a passive process of taking in information. Our brains are actively interpreting and making sense of the world around us. And speaking of interpreting, the source mentions those genetic variations in color vision, in humans.
Yeah, right. There are genetic variations.
Like that gene, OPN1LW, on the X chromosome, which is involved in red color detection.
Yes.
And those variations can lead to different forms of color blindness.
Absolutely.
And even like subtle differences in color perception between men and women.
Right. The opsin proteins involved in color vision across different animals actually share a common ancestor from like 500, 800 million years ago, indicating that even early Cambrian animals could distinguish colors. About 220 million years ago, early mammals were primarily nocturnal, and they had blue-yellow dichromatic vision, a trait that persists in most mammals today.
Right.
Anthropoids and a few monkey species are the only known trichromatic mammals.
Oh, that's us and some of our primate cousins.
Exactly. With the development of sensitivity to shorter green and longer red wavelengths, about 50 million years ago. Now, interestingly, howler monkeys are the only New World monkeys where trichromatic vision evolved independently. The source notes that this development coincided with a significant reduction in the number of genes related to smell in humans and other anthropoids.
So it's almost like as our vision improved, our sense of smell took a back seat.
You could say that.
It's so fascinating how the senses can evolve and even kind of trade off against each other. And I remember the source talking about like snakes that can see in infrared.
Right.
And they use their jaws as receptors for low frequency vibrations.
Right. Like vipers, for example.
Yeah, vipers.
They perceive more movement than shapes, and they use their tongues to, quote unquote, smell in stereo.
It's like they're experiencing a completely different sensory world than we are.
They really are. And the source also touches on spatial vision, noting that predatory mammals, reptiles, and birds, like owls, with their forward-facing eyes, have a narrower field of view but excellent depth perception.
Right, that makes sense. They need to be able to judge distances accurately when they're hunting.
Exactly. Whereas herbivores and some birds with eyes on the sides of their heads, they have a much wider field of view, sometimes even up to 360 degrees.
Wow.
But they lack good stereoscopic vision and depth perception. Vision, in general, provides information that helps to create a spatial orientation map in the brain, contributing to the development of specific forms of memory and information processing.
So, okay, big question here. Why don't we have all these other cool sensory abilities? Like, why can't we see in infrared or see through walls like Superman? It seems like that would be pretty handy.
Well, the source addresses this pretty directly. We lack an electric sense and infrared vision because, simply put, we didn't need them.
Right.
We evolved in an environment where those senses wouldn't have given us a significant survival advantage. And nature isn't all powerful. It can't easily create detectors for these kinds of radiation by modifying the mammalian body plan.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's all about what provides a survival advantage without requiring an exorbitant biological cost, right? Like, extra eyes might be cool, but the evolutionary cost of developing entirely new sensory mechanisms in mammals hasn't been worthwhile.
Right. It all comes down to that cost-benefit analysis that evolution is constantly doing.
Okay, now the source switches gears to another uniquely human ability, language. Only humans use such complex spoken language for communication.
Right.
And it seems like this might be due to the presence of specific neural structures in our brains that are absent in animals.
Potentially.
In language learning, it happened so quickly, despite relatively limited stimulation and a lack of extensive negative examples to define word meanings.
Like, it's amazing how quickly kids pick up language without being explicitly told all the time what not to say.
It is, and it almost feels like there's an innate wiring for it.
Right.
Now, learning a specific language is not a result of natural selection, of course.
Right.
But the underlying ability to understand and learn language likely is.
Okay.
And this precise control that's needed to modulate the movements of the tongue and vocal cords, this is something that animals just haven't been able to master.
Right, right. And I remember the source mentioning that gene FOXP2, which is often called the language gene.
Yes, FOXP2.
It's associated with speech production and comprehension disorders in humans.
Right.
But interestingly, it's also active in birds during the learning of mating songs.
It is.
And it plays a role in echolocation development in bats.
That's right. So FOXP2 encodes proteins that are found in mammals, birds, fish, and reptiles. And get this, the Neanderthal version of this gene was the same as in humans.
Whoa. So that suggests that they may have had some level of language capability as well. Potentially, yes. It's a fascinating area of research. So the genetic basis for language might actually be much older and more widespread than we initially thought.
Okay, so now what about the purpose of the brain itself? Like, why did it even evolve in the first place?
The source states it pretty clearly. The brain's fundamental purpose is to control complex behavior.
Okay, so it's not just about thinking. It's about doing.
Exactly. And it uses this great example of songbirds. Their brain size actually increases during the mating season when they need those complex singing abilities to attract mates.
Oh, wow.
And then it shrinks back down when those functions aren't as critical.
So it's a use it or lose it thing, even on an evolutionary timescale.
Precisely. And then there's this really fascinating example of the sea squirt.
The sea squirt.
Yes. As a larva, it swims around and has a brain and a nerve cord, very much like a tadpole.
Okay.
But once it reaches maturity and attaches itself to a rock, forming these colonies, it actually absorbs its own brain because it no longer needs to move to filter food.
Whoa, that's wild.
It is. It's this clear demonstration that movement and the brain are intrinsically linked.
If you don't need to move, you don't need a brain.
Right. And, you know, it's also a good reminder for us humans. We need to keep our brains active, keep those neural pathways firing. If you don't use it, you lose it, as they say.
That's a bit scary to think about.
But also motivating.
Yeah, true. Okay, so from poo.